Welcome to the Jerusalem Post podcast. I'm Yaakov Katz and joined, as always, by Lahav Harkov.
Así va Messi al arco.
Lahav, have you been watching the games?
No. Not at all.
Not at all.
Have you?
So, can I be honest? We should always be honest.
Yeah.
I've never paid any attention to the World Cup, but this time I am, and I'm watching the games because I have a 10-year-old son at home. And I guess 4 years ago, he didn't care much about this, but now he does. So we stay up till... You know, I keep him, like, he stayed up the other night till 11:30 watching Messi, right? Beat Argentina, beat Croatia, right? This is what you do as a father. You sacrifice for your son.
I basically only watch sports socially. So, like, if someone invited me to a viewing party, I'd go. You know, it's the same, like, the only football I've ever watched is the Super Bowl, basically, you know? But otherwise, I don't really care.
I'm also not the biggest sports guy, but I will say it's enjoyable. I mean, it's like, it's impressive. These guys are really good. And I don't know anything about soccer, but these guys are really, really good. And it's enjoyable to watch. We actually made some noise today. Speaking of the World Cup, we're talking on Wednesday. And we had a very interesting front page, which was an ad, and it said at the top communicated, but it was a photo, like a collage style photo of the Kotel, the Western Wall, with the Dome of the Rock in the background, mosque with the golden top. And then this really beautiful image of the coach of the Moroccan national team and some of the players of the Moroccan national team. And it says at the top, "We are all Moroccans." And at the bottom, there's this apparently slogan that fans have been chanting called Seer or something like that, which means go. So it has that in Arabic and then in English. And it's making a bunch of noise all over social media, at least.
Yeah, you know, it's I mean, first of all, I think people maybe are not so familiar with the full page ad on the front page thing. Like, we've done it before, but it probably doesn't happen more than once or twice a year. So a lot of people were like, oh, the J Post is endorsing Morocco. And I'm like, no, this is an ad.
Right.
But also French people are just so offended.
Mm-hmm.
Which is really, really interesting. I feel like, you know, if they want to put a full page ad in the Jerusalem Post, I don't think anyone would say no to them.
No. By the way, the best tweet was the French embassy in Israel, in Tel Aviv, which took a photo of the front page of the paper, put a French flag on it, right, and said, "We beg to differ, Jerusalem Post," and then tweeted that out. So it seems like this might be creating something of a bit of a diplomatic spat between Morocco and France. But I mean, put the jokes aside, I think there's something extremely interesting that's been happening. And between, you know, obviously in the Arab world, there's a lot of support for Morocco. They're going to be playing tonight. So this podcast will obviously come out later after we know whether they've advanced to the finals or they lost to France. But Israelis seem to largely be supportive of Morocco at the same time that a lot of the Arab world is. And then there's like this whole group, right, who are, how can an Israeli support Morocco when Moroccan players are waving Palestinian flags at the games? I mean, what's your take on all that?
So first of all, I mean, there are a lot of Israelis of Moroccan origin. And then there's also just the fact that it's like something really exciting and different, right? Like, no Arab team has ever done this well. I think it's possible that no African team has ever done this well either.
Right.
That's exciting and interesting. And so I see a lot of Israelis who are really into it. About the political thing, like, my question is this. There was a big fuss made and continuing to be made, but more at the beginning, that no pro-gay signs or any political or religious signs can be used at the World Cup. And it was... You know, and FIFA threatened to, like, penalize team captains that were going to put, like, a rainbow flag on their uniform because they said no politics allowed. How is waving a Palestinian flag not politics? The Palestinians are not playing in the game, so it would be different if they were. I mean, they are members of FIFA. But for Morocco to be waving a Palestinian flag Oh, and the other thing that they're doing, because you can't just say it's the national flag versus an only political flag, is that they're banning the pre-revolution Iranian flag. Like, there are people who brought the Iranian flag of the Shah, and that's also banned. Mm-hmm. There's just, like, total hypocrisy on display, which is, of course, not surprising from Qatar. But, you know, that part really annoys me about the flags.
So can I push back on that for a moment? Because here's what I, you know, to the people who are critical of the flag situation. So I kind of look at it and I say to myself, one second, the Qataris, they're an Arab country in the Gulf. They do not like us particularly. They're big supporters of Hamas and are cozy with the Iranians. These are no secrets, right? Morocco, Arab African country, that definitely makes sense why there would be some allegiance to the Palestinians and affinity or sympathy to the Palestinians and solidarity. Other Arabs who are there. And the LGBTQ flag, right? So while that, you know, that is definitely a very strong political statement, it goes against their social and cultural norms. Not that I think, of course, people should be able to do whatever they want, but I'm saying I can understand why they're drawing a red line. Here, like, why are we so surprised that Arabs are going to wave a flag of a people who they feel are oppressed and are occupied and are not treated well? We have good relations with Morocco. We at the Jerusalem Post just did a big conference in Morocco. I think, you know, we have normalization with Morocco. Hundreds of thousands of Israelis are going annually to Morocco. But there is some sympathy for the Palestinians. I mean, that shouldn't surprise us, right?
No, I'm not surprised by it. I just think it's hypocritical. I also think it's like FIFA was trying to enforce these rules, right? FIFA is not Qatar. Like, yes, they've clearly made great concessions to the country that's hosting it, but I just think, like, politics is politics. Like, if they have a no politics rule, then it should be applied, you know, to everyone.
It's a no politics rule as long as it fits their agenda, right? As if you can bash the Jews, then it's all good, right? Somehow over time, that has always proved to be the unifying factor of the world.
I joked at the beginning of the World Cup that, like, a lot of Israelis seem to choose who to root for based on, like, who they think is least anti-Semitic, right? So, like, if we're talking about Morocco versus France, like, France is very good right now, but they also, you know, collaborated with the Nazis and had the Dreyfus Affair and everything. So, like, this game can be played forever, you know?
How Jews should support football teams. Someone told me there's, like, a Facebook group that analyzes, you know, who's better for the Jewish people. So, like, Argentina or Croatia. So Croatia, you know, they were collaborators in some of the Nazi crimes. On the other hand, the Argentinians gave refuge to Nazis after the war. You know, Adolf Eichmann hid out in Argentina. So kind of who should Jews really support? These are really tough, tough questions. I don't know if we kind of looked at the world, there will always be some, we won't be able to support anyone. We can just support Israel, but Israel doesn't make it to the World Cup. So we're always going to have a problem.
Yeah, true.
What's your take moving to the Knesset, which, despite the war, you know, there was a great image that I saw of Netanyahu and the new speaker of the Knesset, Yariv Levin, sitting in the in parliament last night as they were passing the new series of laws that are going to pave the way for them to swear in their new government, and watching on an iPhone the game of Argentina against Croatia. But they were doing that while passing some very controversial bills.
Yes, that picture is, like, iconic. I think of them watching, you know, the Argentina game on that little phone. But the bills are, of course, important going forward. Basically, the reason, you know, I think after this election, like, everyone thought, like, coalition talks are going to go really fast because this is the pro-BB bloc. Like, they all said they're going to be a coalition with BB. They don't really have other choices. So, you know, yalla.
Right.
But, of course, here we are. Netanyahu had to ask for an extension. He got 10 days instead of 2 weeks. And part of the reason is these bills, which basically a bunch of the coalition partners have demanded things in the negotiations that require changes in laws, and they will not, you know, be sworn in as a new government until these things move forward. So we had the Ben-Gvir law bill. Well, these are bills. They haven't passed in final readings yet, but they passed in first readings. Ben-Gvir, it gives more authority to the public security minister, which is now going to be called the national security minister. Anyway, it gives them more authority over decisions being made in the police, because there was a, it was a pretty weak ministry, at least in recent years. Like, most things were done by the police themselves and not by the minister. And so Ben-Gvir wants more power. And there's the Smotrich law, which allows a minister within the defense ministry, so not the defense minister himself, to have the authority over the civil administration of the West Bank, which is basically the defense ministry, IDF, combined sort of government of Israeli settlements, but also of certain things pertaining to Palestinians. And then the third is the Derry law, which we've discussed at length, Derry's legal troubles and what that means about him being a minister or not. So this is to allow, the law states currently that if you are in prison, you cannot become a cabinet minister. Now it's set, but the problem is the Israeli term for probation, it basically is officially like prison on probation. Mm-hmm. And so they had to change the wording of the law to allow someone who is on probation, like Aryeh Derry, soon to be interior minister, to allow him to be a minister. So those all passed in their initial readings last night.
I mean, it's pretty amazing how it's very, everything is personalized, right? And what else is also just so interesting is how, you know, usually I would have thought that first you swear in the government and then you pass the bills that you need. But here they're doing it the other way around.
Yeah, that's what's really unusual here. The fact that there's these sort of personal laws being passed, unfortunately, has happened before. This is not the first law passed under Derry's name. There's like famously the Mofaz law, which allows people to break off from one party and still get certain funding for their party and things like that. But yeah, it reveals a lack of trust between the coalition partners that I think maybe would be unexpected from people who have been campaigning for like 4 years now about them all being on the same team.
What is their lack of trust of, though?
Netanyahu, mostly, I think.
Right. So it's the guy who they want to be prime minister, who they said they're part of a block of, they don't trust that he'll actually do what he said he would do or give them the authority that he promised to do. So they're only going to go into the government once they have the authority that he said he would give them.
Correct. They right. want it to be like, as Israelis say, they want it to be like in the bunker. They want it to be 100% sure, safe, that this is going to happen. And therefore, they require changes of laws just to swear in a government.
I mean, it's, you know, if we thought we were out of this, it's not over yet, right? And his deadline now is next Wednesday. Is that right?
Yes.
Next Wednesday, he has to swear in a government. And then, but actually, he can announce that he succeeded in creating a government. Then he gets another few days till he actually has to bring it to a vote in the Knesset. So he might actually have a little more wiggle time. But it's pretty amazing that it seemed like such an ideological aligned block from the get-go. It should have been a walk in the park, but it hasn't been. It's been complicated and difficult. And what else I found interesting, Lahav, is that, you know, usually in the past, when people who were negotiating with Netanyahu held out, you had his like supporters in the media or on social media who would go after these guys and attack them. And they've been relatively quiet. Right. Those people. And then, you know, without getting into specific names, but they haven't been necessarily attacking Smotrich and the ultra-Orthodox
parties. Yeah, but I'll tell you why.
Yeah.
Because like Lapid and others in the outgoing government, but really Lapid has been the leader of it, has been so harsh and so critical, which, again, you know, it's his prerogative and everything, but that the sort of internet attack dogs have a lot of material to work with for Lapid. So they're not working as hard, I think, on like the Haredim or on Smotrich.
Someone said to me that it's also like, who do you go for? The father or the mother? Like, you know, on the one hand, they're kind of torn. Like, so you can't say Smotrich is not right wing, right? So, you know, what are you going to attack him for? He is authentically right wing.
I don't know. They attacked Bennett before Bennett really did anything that you could be accused of not being right wing for.
So you're saying the truth doesn't matter that much?
When it comes to trolls, no. Not really. Also, you know, Likud is mad at Netanyahu because they feel like he's like giving too much away and not saving enough for them. And they really are half of the coalition, you know. So I think numerically they'll still be half of the cabinet, but they're going to have a lot of these ministries that are just like scraps of ministries.
Half ministries, quarter ministries. Yeah. We have a great interview coming up with Roya Hakakian, who is a writer, poet, and advocate, a former Iranian Jew who moved to the United States shortly after the Islamic Revolution. She actually testified recently before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, has actually been targeted by Iranian operatives in the United States. So we're going to talk to her about kind of her work to draw attention to the protests that are still ongoing in Iran, which is pretty remarkable. But before that, Lahav, you have a message for our listeners?
Yeah, this is going to be my last episode of the podcast for a while. I'm starting my maternity leave.
Bezrat Hashem.
Thank you. Keep listening. Yaakov will have a lot of great guests and hopefully co-hosts in the next few months. And then I'll be back.
Well, we will miss you, Lahav, but we wish you and the family. This is number three, right? So
yes.
You're going up in numbers. We wish you lots of luck and b'sha tova, as we say, sheb mazal tov. Everything should go well. And we look forward to getting you back on the podcast.
Thank you.
Here we go with Roya Hakakian.
I am here with Roya Hakakian, who is a writer who's written some very interesting books about her childhood and young adulthood in Iran before she moved to the United States, and also about the immigrant experience in the U.S., and has spoken out quite a bit about the protests going on in Iran. And we're speaking to you, I think, just minutes after the UN voted to remove Iran from its commission on women. And there was an overwhelming vote against Iran. A symbolic move, but what do you think about it?
You know, sometimes symbolism means a great deal. A year and a half ago, when Iran was first appointed to the council, I wrote a piece for the Washington Post saying that it was absurd. And you know, I felt, as many other women, and I hope feminists from around the world felt, it was an absurd decision. It was happening exactly when Iran was arresting women throughout the country, was committing all sorts of violations against women. And to think that, you know, a world body would make such a decision was an insult. And so I think it's a good sign. It's symbolic. I'm sure, hurt their reputation in a small way, it doesn't have a serious consequence. But at this very moment, I think Iranians would like to know that the international community is paying attention and is hearing their voices. And in that way, I commend the decision.
I want to go back just a moment to life in Iran. So, you know, you left for the U.S. shortly after the revolution.
Not shortly, Yako.
A few years after, mid-80s or so, if I got that right.
1984.
So about 5 years after. But yeah. I read this great essay that you did with this freelance cartoonist, Women, Life, and Liberty, an illustrated essay, which I thought was really interesting and unique. And you write about, you know, how when you were a small girl, that's when the mandatory dress code, the hijab, became the law. And then how when you were a teen, the morality police began making the rounds. So I'm just, you know, just for our listeners and people who I don't know fully understand, what does that mean, morality police? You know, it's been in the media recently. It was abolished. It wasn't abolished. It's still there. It's not still there. What is life like for a young woman walking on the streets of Iran? And what is it like with this morality police?
If you're going back, let's go to the very, very beginning in some ways. Let's go to 1979. So in February of 1979, you know, Ayatollah Khomeini returned to Iran, and the Iranian revolution, as we know it, became a success in middle of February. And then the new regime, the Islamic Republic, took over. There was a decree from the Ayatollah to establish a provisional government, which happened. But then he began, at the end of that February, to talk about bringing back the hijab, which is very interesting, because you would think that in a country where a revolution has occurred and is so new, and there's so much chaos and so much anxiety about so many other things that are in a state of flux, that what happens or doesn't happen to women's hair would be inconsequential. but it wasn't. And so the Ayatollahs started saying that women need to dress in an Islamic fashion, and I would like for them to put on the hijab. And then subsequently, on March 8th of 1979, women took to the streets to say, at a time when no one else was challenging the Ayatollah, women took to the streets on March 8th and said, we didn't make a revolution to go backwards, which was astounding, incredible, historic, brave, whatever adjective you apply to that event, it basically sticks because it was a very outstanding move. However, the Ayatollah, you know, accepted that it was too soon to bring it back, and you know, others who were his closest allies and consiglieres told him that it was not a good time to create so much dissatisfaction, and he took a step back and said that it was merely a suggestion. But clearly it wasn't, because 2 years later, it became the law in Iran. And as it became a law, there came a this police, which basically prowled the streets. When I was living there, they were in Toyota pickup trucks that just, you know, circulated throughout Tehran, and they would stop anyone, especially women, who appeared in a way that violated the Islamic dress code laws. In my time, the dress code laws were far more strict than dress code laws have been in the past several years. You know, that was very, very, the very beginning of the Iranian Revolution, and everything was far more radical and strict, especially since the Ayatollah still was alive and ruling. So you, as a woman, didn't even have a choice to pick the color of your outerwear. You had to pick from brown, navy blue, black, or gray, and nothing else was allowed. You know, when I left Iran, one of the things that really astounded me when I went to a mall to do some shopping, it was the array of colors that I hadn't seen in a very long time. I was seeing oranges and reds and yellows for the very first time, you know, in the racks in you know, department stores, which had been several years. You know, in those days, the morality police wasn't just there for women specifically. There were also laws against men wearing short sleeves or short pants. And by the way, there was also, you know, they would stop women for makeup, for instance. Or manicured nails. So all of these things would be reason enough for the morality police to stop you. You know, if they were very nice, they would give you a warning and let you go. But if they were more strict, as they were in the case of Mahsa Amini, the woman whom they stopped in September and who was killed in custody, they may detain you and take you away, which is what happened in this case.
So today, right, the protests that we see going on now happened because morality police stopped this woman, Mahsa Amini, for her scarf sort of having fallen down, not covering enough hair, and they beat her. She died in the hospital. What are the rules today? And are you able to give any clarity to this situation where for 5 minutes there, it seemed like they were doing away with the morality police, but then people said that no, it's still there and that it's just spin. What is going on there now?
Well, I wrote a piece about this for The Atlantic about, you know, whether or not Iran was abolishing the morality police. And my verdict was that, you know, the authorities in Iran know precisely what the West wants to hear. And they knew that, you know, if they appeared as though they were hearing the voices of the movement, and they were appeasing the protesters in some ways, that, you know, Westerners who are exerting pressure on the Iranian government may back off a little. And as I say in the piece, it actually really did work somewhat, because as soon as the announcement came, the U.S. Secretary of State was interviewed on a morning news program in the U.S. And he said, in response to, what do you think about, you know, the idea of abolishing the morality police, as we have heard from Iran, he said, well, it's up to the Iranians, but if this is a response to the needs of the protesters, we welcome it and we think it's a good sign. So I think that there was an effort, and there is an effort inside Iran to try to show that they're addressing the issues, they're addressing the demands of the protesters in order to lessen the amount of pressure. But I don't think that these efforts are coordinated strategically on the part of, you know, across the board between all the agencies and decision makers inside the government. And therefore, you know, one says something and the other one denies it, which is precisely what happened. But all in all, I think it's very representative of the way Iran has conducted diplomacy in the past 25 years, that you never know who's making what decision. And that has left the West in a position of always thinking that there are some, softer elements within the Iranian regime with whom they can negotiate. And I think, you know, the idea of the reformist hardliner was, you know, an extension of this. And as is this decision to abolish the morality police, but, you know, another faction in the government comes out and says, no, we have no intention of abolishing the morality police. But I just think that it's a pattern of how they have been managing bad publicity.
And it's a pattern of how the West doesn't understand what happens in Iran.
Precisely. I think it's the best game of good cop, bad cop that has been played diplomatically anywhere in the world.
So you recently gave testimony before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and I read somewhere how some senators came up to you afterwards and you spoke about how this was the most serious movement that Iran's seen in 40 plus years, maybe since the revolution itself. And they said, nah, you know, there's protests all the time. We've seen this happen before. It was actually interesting. Barack Obama, who was president right during the green, so-called green protest of 2009, and he actually was on a podcast not long ago. You probably saw this, and he said that it's one of his regrets is maybe he should have spoken up more at the time, but they were afraid in the administration that if he had been more vocal, then it would kind of feed the Iranian narrative that this is anyhow a U.S.-led attempt to overthrow the regime. So he did stay quiet, but it was interesting to hear him kind of repent that what he did, you know, a bunch of years ago. But I'm curious, in your sense, what makes this time so different? What is it that's happening that this one is really maybe a game changer?
It is a game changer in that the demands of the protesters aren't the demands that we have ever heard emerge from Iran. In 2009, the protesters were on the street saying, where is my vote? Where is my vote is a very polite, albeit angry, demand that was put to the government, to the authorities, saying, please pay attention to what we are asking for and give us what we want, which essentially implies that there is an ongoing conversation still between the nation and the rulers, the leadership. So that was 2009, which by all intents and purposes was the, you know, the most climactic round of protests in Iran after perhaps the 1999 student uprisings, which wasn't as big and as significant as the 2009 Green Movement. But right now, what's going on And what the protesters are demanding has nothing to do with what happened in 2009. There is no dialogue between the demonstrators on the streets and the leadership. There is nothing that they're demanding from the leadership other than for them to go. And most importantly, I think in some ways, to me, someone who has been listening to all the voices and all the sounds that have been coming out of Iran since 1979, nothing about these protests sounds polite. The politeness, the reverence, the respect that people seem to reserve mm-hmm. for the supreme leader, for Ayatollah Khomeini, the founder of the Islamic Republic, have all fallen away.
So you sense a lot more anger today than in the past?
No, it's more than anger. What I'm saying is that there is absolutely no conversation. There is nothing that the people are asking from this regime, because they do no longer believe that the regime can deliver anything that they want. And I think whatever legitimacy that the regime seemed to have is no longer there. And I think whatever religious reverence they had reserved, or a sense of, you know, authority or respect that they attributed to the leadership, especially to the supreme leader and the founder, is no longer in place either. So it's far more than anger. It's a, you know, irreversible divorce.
Well, what do you think brought them to this point? Because of course, you know, that's been a tyrannical authoritarian regime for decades. So what changed now?
Well, you know, I think people tried it in every which way to get what they want through any other means other than a revolution, and it didn't work. I think it actually shows a great deal of restraint on the part of the Iranian people to have tried, you know, in 1999 to have been asking for reforms then. Because, you know, if you remember, the reform movement in Iran began in 1997 with the rise of President Khatami to power. And 2 years later, university students took to the streets, and that was the first of, you know, the major demonstrations in Iran. And nothing happened then, even though a reformist president was in office. Later on, you know, people took to the campaign of Mir Hossein Mousavi, who was running against Mahmoud Ahmadinejad in 2009. And, you know, Mir Hossein Mousavi, who was a popular candidate at the time, had been a prime minister in Iran, had been vetted and approved by the supreme leader. And people went to vote for him because they wanted, you know, an alternative to Ahmadinejad. And the elections were rigged. Or at least that's what people thought. And that brought about the 2009 Green Movement. So what did that mean? It meant that even if people were agreeable to vote for a candidate that the supreme leader had approved, if it weren't exactly a hardline candidate that he had completely endorsed, that no amount of voting could get them anywhere. And that's precisely what happened. Then in 2019, there were a series of economic protests throughout Iran that the regime very violently dealt with, you know, killed something close to 1,200 people, according to Amnesty, within the span of 1 week. And that's how they crushed that round of protests. This time around, the people have come to the conclusion that if there is a reformist in office, as there was in 1999, nothing will ever be done. That if they go to the voting booths and in large numbers vote for a candidate whom they want, it will not happen. And if they take to the streets and ask legitimately for economic relief, they will be dealt with violently. So what else does that leave for a nation other than to pour into the streets and revolt and try to undermine the regime at the base of it?
A couple of years ago, or even maybe it was more recent, you had two what seemed like federal officials, maybe FBI agents, who came to your house and told you that you were a potential target, or you were a target for Iranian operatives. And we know that they had tried on multiple occasions to potentially kill other Iranians who reside in the United States. So it wasn't the first time. This is something that they actually openly, well, maybe do it. And I'm curious the feeling that that was for you at the time and how you managed that. And did that maybe try, did that create a fear that maybe you shouldn't be speaking up as much as you do?
Well, it wasn't the first time that, you know, the FBI had come to me or alerted me. I had published a book in 2011, which had basically offered a non-fictional account of Iran's extrajudicial operations, terror operations against dissidents throughout Europe. And that had really upset the regime. And I had heard from the FBI after the release of that book too. I think what made it scarier this time around, this most recent incident, was that unlike the past, when Iran had wished to carry out operations in the United States and couldn't because the United States had proven to be far more of a security fortress before, this time around, there is reason to believe that elements from within the regime have infiltrated the United States. And I just don't get the sense that the security that was in place, that I could count on in the past, is still in place now. So I think for whatever reason, the United States somehow became more vulnerable in the past 5 to 10 years to the infiltration of Iranian elements. And it is that presence that I think is worrisome. Yes, of course, for me, as an Iranian American, but I think for Americans too in general, that it's just a bad sign if they have been able to, you know, make our country their home.
Right. And as we saw with the Salman Rushdie incident, it could be people who live in America who are sort of carrying out the work of Iran. So it is definitely a scary situation.
Yes. And I think the Salman Rushdie case shows that rather than use some, you know, some of their old models of terror operations, you know, send in people into countries where they want to rid themselves of, you know, a dissident or someone they deem an enemy, they are now using newer strategies, which included using, you know, sympathizers to the regime or to the Islamist ideology to do their dirty work. And I think this is scary because it is something new. And, you know, a lot of these characters do are living in the United States, and to think that they can be recruited by the regime is quite worrisome.
Yeah, we've seen it. I mean, there's been a couple of attacks that Israel has thwarted recently on like Israeli businessmen or Israeli tourists in Georgia and in Turkey, where it was just people of a different nationality entirely that Iran succeeded in recruiting. So yeah, right. It is a strategy. It is a tactic that they're trying around the world right now. Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask you about a different topic you've written about. You wrote a book about the sort of immigrant experience to the U.S. and it was very patriotic and I think like loving of America in a time where I feel like a lot of people in America on the left and the right are feeling a little down on their country. And so it was a refreshing thing to see. And I was wondering if you could speak to that a little bit, that maybe the immigrant experience or maybe coming from a place like Iran after the revolution sort of gives you a different perspective and a gratitude for America.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I think, and I've said in the past that immigrants don't come to America just to clean homes, mow lawns, or, you know, staff hospitals or pick berries, you know, in the farms. We also come to America to remind Americans of some of the things that they assume is part of the natural decor in this country, namely democracy. I think it's for an immigrant who has fled an authoritarian regime, one of the most important contributions to make to this country, especially at this particular point, is to help the native-born Americans see some of the traces of democracy manifest itself in the day-to-day life of, you know, life in America. I think sometimes when you have been born and raised with all these privileges, you fail to be able to see them. And, you know, it's very easy for me to identify them. You know, the fact that I can dress as I wish and leave my house and not worry that I may be stopped or taken away because I've dressed a certain way is amazing. The fact that I can leave my home with someone I love, man, woman, whatever. We can hold hands on the street, you know, embrace each other. And not be stopped and taken away is a blessing. And all of these things are the gifts that democracy bestows upon us as American citizens. And I think because we have always had them, in some ways, we can't see their value, and we can't see that there have been generations of people long ago who fought and died to establish such a republic. And so I thought, especially in 2016, when, you know, political winds were shifting so seriously in America, I thought, you know, as an immigrant, the best thing I could do was to enable ordinary Americans see all these hidden gifts of American democracy in day-to-day life. And that's precisely what the book is.
Well, Roya, it's been a pleasure to have you on the Jerusalem Post podcast. We really appreciate your time and your insight. And I think, you know, obviously as Israelis, we watch with great interest what's happening in Iran. Usually from Israel, the prism is much more security focused and how it impacts us and weapons, whether it's to Lebanon or Gaza or nuclear development like they've been trying to do for many years. But I think we all share this common hope that the situation can get better for the people of Iran and that they can obtain the freedom that they deserve, as all people do. So we thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for being here.
My pleasure.
Thank you for listening to the Jerusalem Post podcast. If you enjoyed it, please send the link to your friends and family. We're available on Apple Podcasts, Google, Spotify, all major podcast platforms, and we will be back next week.